Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines. This is your weekly Utah news roundup featuring journalists from the Salt Lake Tribune and heard every Friday here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, remembering Orrin Hatch, the longest serving Republican senator in U.S. history and a giant on Utah's political stage. The Ute Indian tribe believes a Uinta Basin rancher is misappropriating its water, but federal courts have declined to intervene. Over objections from rural communities, Washington County is looking to pull water out of previously untapped aquifers to sustain growth in St. George. And almost 20 years after their parents were killed in Brazil, four Utah siblings are still seeking justice. And joining me for this conversation here in studio, we've got Salt Lake Tribune public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley. Thanks for being here, Brian.
You bet, Roger.
On the Zoom, we have Tribune News columnist Robert Gerke. And Robert, thanks as always for being here. Appreciate it.
Yep, happy to be here.
And then later on in the show, we'll be hearing from Tribune reporter Colby Peterson on the saga of that Utah family seeking justice in Brazil. So stick around for that. A reminder to listeners that you can join this show with your tweets today. We can't take calls for the moment, so join the conversation on Twitter by name-checking KCPW. At KCPW is our handle. Orrin Hatch died 6 days ago. He will lie in state at the Utah Capitol this coming Wednesday from 2 to 8 p.m. There's a funeral at the Salt Lake City Stake Center of the LDS Church as well. Robert Gerke, news columnist, you wrote a remembrance for your column this week, and we should also say that you've covered politics in both Utah and D.C. and had various occasions to interact with the senator. You called him a Mr. Smith, who went to Washington and then became deeply entwined with it. But you say that no matter your politics, Hatch's influence and legacy can't be ignored. Tell us a little bit about your remembrance of the senator.
Yeah, there's a line that actually Rod Decker used that I wish I would have thought of. It said he's had more influence in Utah politics than anybody except Brigham Young. And I think that's probably true. You know, he is clearly a giant on our political landscape, an influential politician, both here in Utah, and obviously, and at the national level. As has been mentioned repeatedly, the longest serving Republican senator in history. He'll probably be overtaken by Charles Grassley in that regard, but it's quite a career. And if you think about it, for people of my generation, at least, for pretty much our entire lives until the time he retired, he has been the senator from Utah. So I think it's fair to say he has a huge impact on Utah politics and Utah history. You don't have to like Orrin Hatch. Obviously, there are a lot of people, including myself, who maybe have some issues with his policies. But, the size of the shadow he cast over Utah politics is immense.
I think of him, Robert, as a Utahan, as intrinsic to here and, you know, I guess also intrinsic to Washington. But he was actually not from this place. He was originally not a Utahan. He was from Pittsburgh, an interloper in Utah politics to start.
Right. He was born in Pittsburgh. And there's been a lot written about how he grew up in a shack. You know, in pretty extreme poverty, he took up basketball and boxing and learned to play the piano and the violin. He's a complex character, I think, in that, you know, one of his big legislative accomplishments was the Children's Health Insurance Program.
Right.
It was a bill that he partnered with Ted Kennedy on. His staff, I was told by his longtime chief of staff, his staff had warned him to, you know, not trust Kennedy, not become his patsy and you know, get conned into sponsoring this bill. And Orrin had just pulled him all aside and said, look, you don't understand what it's like to be poor. Let's go get this done and do it in a way that I can live with. And it kind of shows, I think, in some regards, the way that upbringing influenced him. Obviously, the music influenced him because he continued to write songs and poetry into his late years. He's a sort of complicated character. I also found him to be kind of fragile, very, you know, this is not unusual for politicians, but he was very aware of what people thought and said about him. And certainly there were instances where, you know, we heard about things that he didn't like that we had written, but, you know, that and it was interesting when he would raise those, just because he was, you know, so powerful on the national stage, he still cared what, you know, the local paper was saying about him.
Yeah. An oft-told story is that he ran, you know, when he first ran for office, he ran on term limits. In his first race, he said he was, you know, not going to stay all that long in D.C., and then he ends up being this very long-serving senator, the longest-serving Republican senator. And you highlighted, you know, among the things that he considered his most significant accomplishment, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, government health care for people who are needy, you know, long before Obamacare came around. Do you want to talk about other things that he saw as accomplishments, what he was most proud of in Washington? I mean, I guess CHIP is probably the big one. I know that he also authored something that never did pass, the DREAM Act.
You know, in a record with his number of accomplishments, there were obviously some that stood out, especially in my mind. I think the CHIP that you mentioned is one of the big ones. He co-sponsored the first AIDS legislation, the first bills to get help AIDS patients get health care. He kind of broke ranks with a lot of Republicans and advocated for stem cell research. He mentioned the DREAM Act he was an early adopter of, and then interestingly kind of had to back away from it because of the political liability at home. Another issue that he let out on was the individual health insurance mandate before Hillary Clinton recommended it in her legislation, and he had to back away from that. So, you know, his politics, I think, changed in some respects over the course of 42 years. I think everybody's will, you know, where he kind of moved one way and then moved back as political pressures kind of pushed him in that direction.
Yeah.
You know, and so he's, but yeah, the Hatch Foundation says that he sponsored or co-sponsored more legislation than any other living senator. And, you know, I don't have a way to check that, but I believe it because, you know, he was a guy that, again, talking to people who knew him and worked with him, he knew how to manage the system. He had a good sense of timing, a good sense of, you know, coalition building. And he kind of came from a time, you know, back in the 70s and early 80s when you could do more of that, when it was a more collegial body and, you know, people were willing to work with each other despite their political differences.
Right. Especially the Senate, a sort of reputation of the Senate having that collegiality and his relation, you know, his famous relationship with Senator Ted Kennedy. There's this balance to strike, and you do it in your column. People are hypersensitive these days about making, you know, saints out of public figures in the after, you know, soon after they've passed on. You in your column wrote about his filibustering labor rights and fair housing laws, fighting against social safety net programs, opposing the Equal Rights Amendment and same-sex marriage, helping to craft the Patriot Act, and helping to torpedo the nomination of Merrick Garland and enabling the rise of Trumpism. That, in addition to the, you know, all of the accomplishments and the long shadow you say he cast, and you conclude that love him or hate him, and there are plenty in both camps, it's hard to fathom that any other Utahn will ever match his impact and stature on the national stage. I'm wondering, I mean, he has a successor in Senator Mitt Romney, but politics are different these days, Robert, than they used to be.
Well, I think Senator Romney's in his 70s, so I have a hard time thinking that he's going to stick around to kind of rack up the achievements that Senator Hatch did. Senator Lee potentially could stick around that long, but it's just a different time, you know, and I just don't see the system right now, the way it operates, as being quite as conducive to somebody sort of shepherding through that much meaningful, impactful legislation. So, yeah, I mean, he is a profoundly impactful person. And one of the things that, you know, I kind of constructed the column around this notion that if you hear the word Utah Senator and Orrin Hatch, just he immediately comes to your mind. He's iconic in that respect. And probably if you live outside of Utah and think of Utahn, he's probably one of the first or second people who pops into your head as well, you know? So, yeah, just a remarkable life and impactful human being. Yeah.
Well, I said, you know, he wasn't from here. He was from Pittsburgh, but he undoubtedly became one of the most recognizable faces of Utah and left a big mark here. We do need to head to our first break in the show here in a second, Robert, but is there anything else you want to add?
Yeah, if I could just real quick, that Gordon Monson did a really interesting column as well about Orrin Hatch's sports fandom. He was a super fan of the Utah Jazz, loved going to Utah Utes and BYU football games. So I just recommend that people check that out as well, because it gives you an insight into another aspect of the man.
All right, check that out, sltrib.com. You can also find Robert Gerke's columns at that website, sltrib.com. We need to head to our first break in the show. There's more to come, including two stories on water, one having to do with the Ute tribe, another that looks at tapping an as-of-yet untapped aquifer in southern Utah to fuel development. Stay with us. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brian Maffley and by news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our live Friday morning Utah news wrap-up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting them to @KCPW. Brian Maffley, water stories will never go out of style. I mean, in fact, they will become only more central as this resource gets scarcer. And you've got a couple of water stories this week that illustrate that. Yeah. One is from the Uinta Basin. The Ute Indian tribe says essentially that a rancher up that way has been, you know, stealing their water. Explain this allegation and the venue or venues where the tribe has been making this allegation.
Yeah, the rancher and his granddad practically goes way back. Yeah, earlier this week, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals issued this interesting ruling that Grant asked me to look into. And, you know, on the surface, the ruling has to do with a tribal court's jurisdiction over water disputes between the tribe and non-tribal members. And the 10th Circuit said, no, you don't have jurisdiction, and they are refusing to allow the federal courts to enforce this tribal court's order that the grantor stop diverting this water out of this canal and to pay damages. And so, you know, we went and pulled out the documents from the federal court file, and it's like a trove of really interesting, you know, facts to this case that made it a pretty interesting story. So, you know, to back up what this is about, really, these rulings out of the 10th Circuit are very common when it comes to the Ute tribe's interest in extending its jurisdiction over the 4 million acres that were in the historic boundaries of the Uinta and Ouray Reservation. That's the backdrop here. The tribe is very interested in asserting its sovereignty. And these cases come through all the time. But this one is a new twist, and no one's ever reported on it that I know of. And it has to do with, you know, a water source that was developed over 100 years ago for the benefit of the tribe and its members. And in this case, the canal involved, it crossed over the property held by a rancher named Gregory McKee. And it turns out for years and years, without really anyone knowing, the McKees were diverting water out of this canal to support their agriculture operations, which were extensive. There was a huge feedlot there. 120-acre parcel that McKee owned, plus apparently there's another 160 acres of tribal land that he was using without authorization from the tribe. So when they got wind of it in 2012, because the rancher's estranged wife, you know, essentially blew the whistle and gave a letter to the tribe explaining what this guy was doing, which led to an investigation, which led to a lawsuit in the tribal court filed by the tribe, asking the judge to order to impose a permanent injunction and pay damages, which the tribal judge, his name was Terry Pachota, did in 2015 after a 2-day bench trial, which McKee and his lawyers did not participate in. And basically after that, it was like, well, good luck enforcing this ruling, because the rancher ignored it, which is why the case wound up in federal court in Salt Lake City.
So it was in the tribal legal system found against the rancher, and now goes to the federal court, or goes to the federal court.
So the tribe Yeah, so the tribe went to the federal court asking for their intervention to enforce this tribal court order, and the federal court said no. There has to be a limited number of circumstances having to do with, you know, does the disputed activity, imperil the tribe's political integrity, health and safety, and, and it's like the tribe was like, yeah, duh, yeah, he's taking our water. But the federal court, the U.S. District Court in Salt Lake City disagreed, and it got appealed to the 10th Circuit, and the 10th Circuit agreed as well. The tribal court lacks jurisdiction here.
But is this water that is granted to the tribe or not? Can we know that, or yeah. Don't we know that?
Well, the tribal judge ruled that the water is not available to this rancher. But apparently his ruling isn't worth the paper that it's printed on.
You said that the tribe says this is doing damage, this is doing irreparable harm.
Yeah.
The legal argument that the federal court judges are using to not allow or to not uphold the standing this ruling from the tribal judge is that it isn't doing harm or the tribe just doesn't have standing to actually even bring the case.
The tribe has standing to bring a case, just not to a tribal court. And so the 10th Circuit held that, you know, they pointed out that, oh, this activity has been going on for at least 13 years before they found out about it in 2012. And it turns out it's more like 100 years because the rancher involved, his defense was, look, our family's been using this water for decades and decades, and the use of it had been recognized by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So what's the problem here? And the problem is, according to the tribe, is these were you don't have rights to this water that's flowing across your property. It's from an irrigation project that was developed in the early 20th century for the benefit of the tribes, and it's like you're not part of the tribe, dude. And
yeah, when did the tribe? When was this water allocated to the tribe? Like, what's the history there?
Yeah, well, this goes back to when the UN and Ouray reservations was established through a series of executive actions in the 19th century, starting with in 1861 with Abraham Lincoln. And the reservation was established at 4 million acres. It's huge. It's a whole UN basin practically from, you know, Heber to the Colorado state line. But over the years, the reservation has been, you know, the tribe has lost this land through a subsequent series of actions, starting with action taken by President Theodore Roosevelt in 1905, which opened the reservation up to white settlement. And this is one of the reasons why the town of Roosevelt is named Roosevelt. And so a lot of the land within the reservation, the exterior boundaries, is now out of tribal hands. So ever since, you know, for the last at least 50 years, the tribe has been, you know, fighting over this with the state of Utah over who has jurisdiction over these lands that are no longer tribally held. Huh. And the rulings are nuanced. They really are. And there's been every couple years, probably every couple times a year, it seems like there's a pretty important ruling out of the 10th Circuit about the reach of tribal jurisdiction. And interestingly, you know, Neil Gorsuch wrote some of these opinions, who's now on the Supreme Court.
Right.
And for the most part, they kind of favor the tribe's perspective, point of view. But it is complicated because when you have this, you know, patchwork, pick up sticks of jurisdictions, it makes it very hard to run a government. And a lot of it has to do with law enforcement, but now we see it, you know, coming into the realm of land use.
Right, and water crossing land. Water crossing that patchwork.
Yeah.
A question that I have that's very simple, going back to the story of McKee, is does he have water rights? I mean, does he own these water rights at all, or some version of them?
Yeah, the documents are really complicated, but apparently that family does have rights to water, just not this water.
Again, the sort of interesting tidbit that you mentioned is from the story is that this, you know, this rancher, it was his ex-wife or his estranged wife who went to the tribe and said, hey,
yeah,
you should take a look at what's happening over
Whoa,
here.
Whoa, that letter. Yeah, it's entered into the court files an exhibit. And it's basically you have to take what she says with a grain of salt. But the tribe looked into it and found that there was enough there to take action. But basically what she said was for years they've been pulling water out of the McKee family kind of controls the ditch and has been moving water onto the McKee property. And not only that, they built some, you know, hidden culvert or pipeline that take water to this 4,000 head feedlot. And then they're burying, you know, hundreds of calves die every year and they bury them on the property. I mean, there's a lot of allegations in there. I don't really know how well they hold up, but that was what was alleged in this letter. And the main thing was the use of the water. That was what the tribe wanted to put an end to. And also this relationship that McKee had with a tribal member to for the consideration of $12,000 a year. McKee was giving this person, he was using a 160-acre quarter section. And the tribe feels that that's not appropriate. The land, belongs to the tribe.
Not to this individual.
Yeah, and so they felt that needed to stop as well. And the judge ordered that, but but that ruling doesn't stick. And so it makes you wonder, where should the tribe have gone to enforce its position here? And it doesn't really, I haven't seen it in these filings. And it seems like maybe they should have gone to state court or maybe federal court in Salt Lake City. But here we are, you know, they're 10 years into this without much to show for it.
Have they exhausted all of their legal avenues? I mean, are they still trying to stop this rancher from using the water?
Yeah, I have reached out to the tribe and or their lawyers, and I haven't heard whether this activity is still going on. But it was going on through the trial in 2015. The judge actually made a note of it, and it really annoyed him because he had issued a temporary injunction earlier, the year before. And he was really disturbed that this activity was continuing against his order. And so, you know, this is really an issue of who gets to call the shots in the basin. And the Tenth Circuit has, you know, come down on the side of against the tribe, that its authority is limited. The tribal court, that is, the authority is limited in this type of water situation.
Interesting, because as you pointed out, you know, previous rulings from the Tenth Circuit have favored the tribe, but this one goes against it. Is there a difference in who's making the rulings?
That I don't know. The judge who wrote this week's ruling is a Trump appointee named Joel Carson, who came onto the bench in 2018. So after Gorsuch was elevated to the Supreme Court, that I don't know. I mean, it was a unanimous three judges signed off on it.
Okay. I'm getting into the weeds here. It's a little bit nuanced, but you know, I don't know if Robert Gerke, the news columnist, wants to. Robert, you want to? This is one water story. There's another one to come. So you could save your comments, or you could jump in here if you'd like.
Well, I guess I have a question for Brian. And sorry if you covered this already, but so the path for the tribe now is, do they go back to federal court to try to enforce their water rights, or do they go to state court, or are they just completely out of luck?
Oh, I think they're going to keep pushing this, just from how they've handled these kind of disputes in the past. The next step they can do is ask for an en banc review by the entire Tenth Circuit for this ruling. When I read the case, it's like, God, the tribe has a very strong case that this rancher's activity is, you know, imperiling their political integrity, the health and safety and welfare of tribal members. It seems that, you know, there's a lot more to say about this. But the other thing I guess they could do is to resubmit their case in state court, or federal court in Salt Lake City.
Wow. And we will see what happens there. Brian, I want to turn to the other story that you reported on from a different part. From, you know, we'll head from northeastern to southwestern Utah. And this is a story. Actually, first, let me remind listeners that you're tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, and you can tweet your comments to @KCPW. A supposedly untapped aquifer, Washington County wants to mine it, and this is, again, about there not being enough water down there to support the kind of growth that the region is seeing. Tell us the outline of this story.
Yeah, well, you know, as we see, you know, water resources continually to dry up in our state, there's more and more interest in drilling for groundwater. And that, as we've seen, is super problematic, especially in Iron County. Apparently, there is this really deep aquifer under the Ash Creek drainage in Washington County, and Ash Creek is a pretty big tributary to the Virgin. And so the Utah Geological Survey's known about this aquifer for a long time, but what they don't know is what kind of quality is the water? Is it even potable? And how much there is? So it's at least 1,000, 1,200 feet deep, maybe even deeper, below the aquifers that are already used by these communities in the Ash Creek drainage, namely New Harmony and Canaraville. And that's how I got it. This water right application crossed my radar was those two towns raised some serious objections to Washington County submitting an application for rights to 13,000 acre feet of water there. And the mayors of these two towns were saying, gee, shouldn't, you know, St. George think about slowing down its rate of growth before tapping into, you know, speculative water sources under the ground that oh, by the way, our communities rely on. That's how this, why I got interested in this.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, those two communities are trying to fight this. They say it's going to impact them. I said supposedly untapped aquifer because untapped implies that there's this pool of water just sitting there. But isn't there research showing that all of these pockets of water in the Great Basin are interconnected, and if you draw any of them down, you impact all of them?
Yeah, but, well, the critics of groundwater pumping will all that make that claim. All this groundwater is interconnected somehow, and if you pull it from one area, it could impact someone's wells miles and miles away. And there's really no way to know until you start drawing the water out. And so what we saw, you know, the next county north from Washington County was they were running, you know, running low on surface water. They started pulling water out of the aquifers under the Cedar Valley, and lo and behold, the ground starts sinking. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, when I talked to a city council member from New Harmony for this story, and he pointed out to me, you know, every time, you know, a developer upstream in Cedar City sinks a well, our wells go dry down here in New Harmony. And so they are extremely worried about what Washington County Water District's up to here. So the district, for its part, says, look, we've looked into this. We've conducted these studies. We think that this aquifer is there. They haven't done any exploratory drilling yet to find out for sure what's available, but they plan to do that. And what they're saying is, look, if there's any sign that if we pull water out of this aquifer and it impacts existing water rights holders, this project won't happen. That's what they've told me. But the thing is, you know, once you start developing an expensive water source like that, and it may take years before it's known, before its impacts are show up, and then you've invested hundreds of millions of dollars, and then how do you walk away from that investment?
Right. The idea being that you're not going to know whether or not it's impacting people just by doing the exploration and you know, whatever small tests you might do in a week or two weeks or a month or even a year. And then a lot of, you know, we talk a lot on this show and other shows about drought and water availability, and is development itself not contributing to the problem here, Brian? Meaning that the more land that gets developed or turned into lawns or whatever in the desert, you know, the less water for existing purposes there will be?
Well, I'd say yes and no, because every time you make a subdivision, it's usually on, you know, an alfalfa field, a former alfalfa field, which is notoriously, you know, water hungry crop, and so by, you know, developing this ag land, you may actually be reducing the demand for water.
Interesting, but then, what about the? I mean, then, what is the justification then for tapping these aquifers?
For Washington County and for Iron County as well, they want to diversify their water sources, so they're not reliant just on surface waters. But really, they want to be able to accommodate, you know, the rampant growth that's going on in Southwest Utah. That's what's really driving this.
Is there any? I mean. Deadline on this? Do we know when might be approval for tapping these aquifers?
Yeah, so it's before the Utah Division of Water Rights, and the state engineer, Teresa Wilhelmson, will make the decision. And so right now, we're less than a month into Washington County making its initial application. There's been at least a dozen, probably multiple dozen, protests have been filed, by not just by the towns, but by environmental groups, local, you know, New Harmony residents. I lost count of how many protests were filed. And so the water district will have a deadline of, I don't know, middle of May to respond. And then the state engineer will most likely hold a hearing to determine. And then she has to make a number of determinations before this water right can be awarded. So right now, Ash Creek drainage is fully appropriated. So if the official line from the state engineer is that we can't award any more water rights for this area, so Washington County has to prove that there is, you know, unappropriated water deep down there. However, they haven't done the exploratory drilling yet to know for sure. So right now, it just seems sort of speculative.
It's interesting because it is, if you need to find new water sources to develop, to allow you to develop the land, then there's an incentive, there's something pushing you to do that, and it can make for some interesting claims. We got to, in a second here, turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And Robert Gerke, I thought I would just ask you if you have any comments on the drying West. I mean, I guess it's sort of a follow-up to the last story.
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of hit on it with the drying West. I mean, the old saw is that in the West, we fight over whiskey and drink our whiskey and fight over water. Wow, I mingled that. But, you know, these kinds of conflicts are going to just become more and more common as water becomes more and more precious commodity and something that constrains growth, and particularly in a place like Washington County. I don't think that these conflicts are necessarily new, but they're going to become more and more frequent because, you know, as we all know, we're in the midst of a 25-year long drought at this point, and development puts pressure on water, you know, puts a demand on water, and it's just gonna continue to be a key issue for the future of this state that we got to get our hands around.
Well, at some point, the term drought, you know, implies something temporary, and maybe drought is just the actual condition. With that, I think we have to turn, I'm sorry, for in the interest of time, to our underplayed stories of the week. And Brian Maffley, I'm going to give you the first dibs on this, a pick for underplayed story of the week. This is to save time for a recorded segment.
Yeah, sure. So Tim Fitzpatrick had this story today about this project in Millard County, where there are these hollowed out salt caverns, they're being used to store hydrogen. You know, he's got a $500 million loan from the Department of Energy to advance this project, which is a big deal. The hydrogen that would be stored there would be generated by renewable energy, and then it would be used to fire the rebuilt Intermountain Power Plant, which is transitioning from burning coal to burning a mixture of natural gas and hydrogen. So that the Department of Energy stepped in with $500 million in funding will help these developers, you know, raise money from the private sector to complete this project. And it's, you know, a lot of people are watching it. This could be the a wave of the future for you know creating green energy via hydrogen. Hydrogen in this case would act as a kind of battery, a way to store wind and solar for later use to generate electricity when you really need it.
I have questions.
In theory,
but
that's all. It sounds good on paper, but will it work?
Check it out at sltrib.com, and I'm going to try and dig deeper into that because I want to get questions answered that I have. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, I'm going to point readers to or listeners to something that Brian Schott wrote coming out of the Republican convention last week. The two candidates challenging Mike Lee, Becky Edwards and Allie Isom, each say the other one should drop out. Allie kind of fired the first shot, saying that she has the best chance of beating Lee in the primary. Edwards says, well, I'm the one who's polling ahead and did better at the convention. You should drop out. The notion being that if they're splitting the vote, then neither of them can win, and Mike Lee will win that nomination easily. Today's the deadline for either of them to drop out and not be on the ballot. But it looks like at this point they're both determined to stay in the race.
Wow. Great pick from Robert Gerke for Underplayed Story of the Week. And with that, I got to say goodbye to both of these gentlemen. Brian Maffley, public lands reporter, and Robert Gerke, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Cool. Bye.
Yep. And now on the show, we're going to turn to my conversation with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Colby Peterson, who has been tracking the story of a Utah family seeking justice in a two decades old murder that took place in Brazil. Take a listen. Colby Peterson, Salt Lake Tribune reporter, really appreciate your being here. Thanks for making time.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. You wrote this week about a pretty horrific crime that was committed nearly two decades ago in Brazil. It's something that you've written about before in the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune, and this is follow-up, though this time some of the victims of this crime, meaning the Staley children, the family, they break their silence. And I think what I'm going to ask you to do here for listeners who don't know this story is just to tell us the story of the crime itself to begin with. The year is 2003. A family of six with Utah roots are living in Brazil. Yeah, would you mind just telling us the outline of the story of this crime and maybe start by telling us why this family was living in Brazil?
Sure. So the Staley family was living in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil because Todd Staley, the father, was sent there on assignment by his employer, Shell Oil. He was an executive for Shell. They sent him to Brazil to find out why these joint venture pipeline projects they had with a Brazilian oil company called Petrobras were losing money over years. And he was sent down there to investigate why. So sometime in the early morning hours of November 30th, 2003, Todd and Michelle Staley were brutally attacked as they slept in their beds. Bludgeoned with blunt objects. Todd died during the attack or very soon after the attack. Michelle was gravely wounded. She died 4 days later, even though doctors performed multiple surgeries to try to save her life.
Wow. You know, I mentioned the fact that it's a family of six. This is the mother and father. How old were the couple's children at this time?
The oldest, Wesley, she was 13. Logan, the only son, was 10. Madison, who they called Maddie, was 8. And Carly was 3.
For this piece that you published this week in the Tribune, you interviewed all of the siblings, all four of them. And this is nearly 20 years later. They, in this interview, recounted the tough, you know, traumatic details of their ordeal, and it was Logan, the only boy, who was, as you said, 10 years old at the time, who discovered the crime scene, and he says that there was like an alarm clock going off that that his parents weren't responding to, so he went into their room. I don't know if this is too gruesome, but can you describe what he found when he walked into that room?
Yes, during that interview, Logan did describe what he found that morning. He says he woke up feeling confused. That day, November 30th, was a Sunday, and he remembered this sound. It was his parents' alarm clock going off to wake up the family to go to church. And there was something wrong, though, because the alarm kept going. No one was stopping it. And so He said that he got up out of bed, walked down the hall to their bedroom, where he saw the walls and bed, he said, covered in blood.
Wow. Just a sort of side note that kind of brings it back to the Utah roots of the story is that the church that they would be going to would be a Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the neighborhood in Rio de Janeiro that they lived in, correct?
Yes. They were attending a local ward of the LDS Church.
In your interview with these siblings, again, now in their 20s and 30s, they described being treated pretty terribly in the aftermath of this crime. Wesley Staley, she was 13 at the time. She became, in the eyes of the authorities in Rio who were investigating this, kind of a suspect, right? I mean, or at least they treated her as such.
Yes. Wesley and Logan said that they were separated from their other siblings and then questioned for hours at a time, they said, without a guardian or a lawyer present.
Wow. And they also, in your article, reported to you, I mean, they say that at the time, again, their mother didn't die immediately. She died 4 days later, but that they weren't allowed to see her as frequently as they would have liked to have seen, which is just another detail there.
Yeah, I mean, after Todd and Michelle Staley were killed, authorities controlled where the kids went and who they spoke to. And Wesley told me that while their mother was still in the hospital, unconscious, they weren't allowed to go see her as much as they wanted to.
Hmm. Colby, Wesley says that she sort of became aware of the fact that she was a suspect in this crime through media reports. Can you explain that to us?
She said that it didn't really sink in for her that she was a suspect in the killings of her parents until she saw her own picture circulating in the news.
Hmm. You know, sort of part of that coverage, Colby, and part of what the authorities were sort of pointing to was this toy axe that the family had brought from a trip to Scotland, right?
Yeah, it was a replica of a battle axe, and they bought it as a souvenir. It was a toy. They had brought it to Brazil. Police found it in the Staley's house that they were staying in, and they believed that the axe, the toy axe, was the murder weapon, and that it had been used to kill Todd and Michelle.
But later that was sort of discounted, wasn't it?
Yeah. Tests done on the toy axe for blood came back negative.
Hmm. You know, we're talking about the idea that these young children were, by the authorities in Brazil, being held up as potential suspects. And it went so far as the Brazilian authorities, for a period of time at least, not granting permission for a couple of these kids to leave Brazil to head back home to the U.S. and Utah.
Yes. Wesley and Logan said that they were prevented from leaving Brazil and going home to Utah until Wesley gave a statement to the Brazilian police. They had family members come to Brazil to support the children and help them. They had to hire a lawyer in Brazil and then actually get a court order signed by a judge, and they left the night that they got that order.
Yeah. Eventually, I mean, not to gloss over any of that particular experience, and I know that, for example, they say that when they got on the plane and they heard the voice of the American pilot, they felt a measure of relief. But an arrest was eventually made in this crime. Can you tell us about basically who they landed on as a suspect here?
Yes. In April 2004, so not even a year later, a 20-year-old man named Josiel dos Santos was arrested as a suspect in a break-in at the same housing complex where the Staleys had lived in Rio de Janeiro. And he quickly confessed to killing Todd and Michelle with a crowbar.
The Staley family and their attorneys, they didn't think, and they still don't think, that this man is responsible, or they actually think that there's something bigger lurking in the background as a rationale for why the Staleys were killed. Can you sort of tie all of that together? They don't believe it's this person, and they see something larger looming in the background. And this has to do with why Todd Staley, again, originally was sent to Brazil.
Sure. So they don't believe Dos Santos was the killer because Government documents obtained by the Staley family through Freedom of Information requests say that Dos Santos was actually coerced into giving this confession that he killed Todd and Michelle. Wow. And that he was beaten and tortured and forced into saying this. Also, evidence at the crime scene suggests that Todd and Michelle were bludgeoned by at least two people with blunt objects, according to this document, which also says that DNA found under Michelle's fingernails didn't match DNA from Dos Santos. Instead, what the siblings believe is that their parents were ordered to be killed by Petrobras, the company that Todd was sent to Brazil to investigate in the first place. They believe that he uncovered this huge fraud scheme involving rigged contracts and kickbacks and corruption, and that in order to keep those alleged deeds concealed, Petrobras ordered their parents to be killed. That is what they believe.
Wow. And again, this is an oil giant, Petrobras. It's the state-owned oil company in Brazil. It's a pretty significant allegation. But at the beginning of this, did you not tell us that Todd was sent there with that specific goal in mind, to determine why joint projects between Shell and Petrobras were losing money?
Right. The Staley siblings say their father was a whistleblower and that the alleged corruption that he uncovered in Brazil was the reason that this company had him killed, to keep what he discovered from ever seeing the light of day.
And to that end, they have filed a lawsuit. I mean, they are seeking redress. They're trying to get some sort of justice. How far has it gotten?
So the Staley siblings filed this lawsuit against Petrobras in February, not only alleging that this oil giant ordered their parents to be killed, but also that Petrobras, the Brazilian police, and others sought to cover up these killings and caused them, quote, severe emotional distress. So far, according to their lawyer, Petrobras hasn't responded officially to the lawsuit, but the company has until May 23rd to respond.
Hmm. You know, something that I realized that I left out, Colby, of our description of everything that happened is there was this arrest of Josiel Dos Santos. What became of that arrest? Was he formally convicted? He later, you said, recanted, said that he was the confession was tortured out of him. Do we know where he is now?
So in 2006, Dos Santos was convicted and sentenced to 25 years in prison. But later, he changed his plea to say that instead of killing Todd and Michelle himself, he actually let two men into the Staley's home the night of the attack. And the Staley's lawsuit says that he disappeared after he was released from prison in 2018, but other news outlets have reported that he went into a witness protection program. Either way, his status is murky.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds, I mean, changing your plea to say that you let two men in, it's just fascinating, Colby. What a bizarre saga that you have been reporting on. There's so much more to your story, so many more facets to the story that I urge people to check out at sltrip.com, but how is this family doing, these siblings? You know, maybe you could talk a little bit about what happened to them afterward. Where did they go, and how are they doing today?
So after the many ordeals in Brazil, they actually moved in with their dad's parents in Spanish Fork. Hmm. And they told me that they have a lot of happy memories there. It was a farm. Tons of room to run around and be kids. And they grew up there, and eventually, you know, they all got married, and some of them have their own families. And after their grandparents sold that house and moved away, Madison, the second youngest, actually bought the house and moved into it with her family, bringing that house, which was built by their grandpa and actually their dad in 1980, brought it back into the Staley family.
And a place where they, as you said, have these happy memories. In the meantime, they will continue pursuing their actions to try and find some level of justice. Really interesting reporting, and I'm assuming it's not the end of the story. There's more to come in terms of what you'll be doing.
Definitely more reporting to come. Wesley and the rest of the Staleys are determined to find justice for their family and for their parents, and I'll be following this lawsuit and reporting on it as it unfolds.
Colby Peterson, Salt Lake Tribune reporter, really appreciate your making time again for this, and thanks for telling us about it today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, that's reporter Colby Peterson wrapping up this edition of Behind the Headlines, a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Find podcasts at kcpw.org. Find all of the reporting we've been covering at sltrib.com. And please support your local sources of journalism. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week.